Several years ago, I read a fascinating book called The Devil's Delusion, Atheism and Its Scientific Pretensions, written by a man named David Berlinski. This book especially fascinated me because David Berlinski is a secular Jew, himself an atheist, who has written a book about the possibility of God's existence. While he's not sure that any system of thought or belief is true, as a mathematician, he's convinced that the scientific community has done a poor job of proving that religion is false and that God does not exist. In his introduction, he is describing a scientific study which concluded that a person's capacity to believe in God was actually linked to their brain chemicals. And in conclusion, he says this: "Neither scientific credibility nor sound good sense is at issue in any of these declarations. They are absurd. They're understood to be absurd. And what is more, assent is demanded just because they are absurd." And then he begins to quote, "We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs," the geneticist Richard Lewontin remarked equably in the New York Review of Books, "in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories." Then Berlinski concludes, "Why should any discerning man or woman take the side of science or anything else under these circumstances? It is because," Lewontin explains, "we cannot allow a divine foot in the door." What David Berlinski is acknowledging here is that atheistic scientists make the presumption right from the beginning that God does not exist, and they're even willing to believe things that are absurd in order to preserve and protect that assumption. In their own words, they will not allow a divine foot in the door. You see, they understand that allowing a divine foot in the door leads down a path of logical thought that they don't want to follow. If there is design, then there is a designer. If there is a designer, then there's some purpose for which we were designed. And we are no longer free to live entirely for ourselves. We are answerable to the one who designed us. Revelation 4:11 says, "Worthy are you, our Lord and our God, to receive glory and honor and power. For you created all things, and because of your will, they existed and were created." Right in the middle of that verse is the word "for." "For you created all things." That word "for" marks out a cause or a reason. God is worthy of glory and honor and power because he has created all things. That's what the atheistic scientists work so hard to avoid. If there is a God who created this amazing world, then he deserves glory. If there's a God, then he deserves honor. If there's a God, then he deserves power. If there's a God, then we exist because of his will. We exist because he determined that we should exist. That means we owe our existence to him and that he is worthy of our glory and honor and praise. Let's turn to Psalm 33 this morning. Psalm 33, we're going to start with verse 6. "By the word of the Lord the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth all their host." Just love this, right? We already know that the word is Christ, the second person in the Trinity, and the breath of God is the Spirit. So we, right off, we see the Trinity working together in salvation here. And then in verse 7 it says, "He gathers the waters of the sea together as a heap. He lays up the deeps in storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spoke, and it was done. He commanded, and it stood fast. The Lord nullifies the counsel of the nations. He frustrates the plans of the peoples. The counsel of the Lord stands forever, the plans of his heart from generation to generation. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people whom he has chosen for his own inheritance." Why are we told to fear the Lord and stand in awe of him? Because he spoke, and it was done. Because he commanded and it stood fast. We live in an amazing world, do we not? Whether we admire the majesty of the mountains or the oceans, or study the complexities of even the tiniest of cells or the simplest of cells, there is beauty and design in every aspect of creation. God shows his power in the way that he keeps the seas within their boundaries, and he even controls the weather. But creation should not produce in us a, wow, isn't that cool? Kind of casual amazement in us. It's meant to stop us in our tracks and consider. God spoke the world into existence by his very word. He created something out of nothing. And all this leads to the conclusion, because God made it, it belongs to him. He owns it. Look again at verse 10. The Lord nullifies the counsels of the nations. He frustrates the plans of the peoples. The counsel of the Lord stands forever, the plans of his heart from generation to generation. God made this world, and he has a plan for it. And even though people have rebelled against him, they cannot change God's plan for it. Instead, God frustrates the plans of the people. He's in charge. I want you to stop and consider for a moment how this should change our perspective on life in general. God is the creator and has a claim on his creation. Psalm 50 says the world is his and all it contains. I've been thinking this week, do I really live this way? I think about how God saved me from my rebellious state, but do I recognize that he always had a claim on me because he created me? If God is the creator and this world belongs to him, am I really living life with God's purposes in mind? Do I bring him glory and honor by how I live, or do I continue to live for my own plans and desires? We live in a world that increasingly does not recognize the Lord as its creator. We are now taught as fact that we were mere accidents as species evolved over millions of years. Even Christians debate among themselves whether evolution played a role in creation, whether the earth is old or new, or whether a 24-hour day is the biblical day, or whether that day could be longer. I don't really want to spend our time this morning covering those kinds of arguments. There are really good resources out there if you want to study those more in depth. What I want to emphasize today is what happens when society no longer recognizes God as the creator. One of the characters in Ivan Dostoevsky's novel, The Brothers Karamazov, claims that if God does not exist, then everything is permitted. You see, our views of right and wrong, of good and evil, are defined by who God is. He created this world. It's his holiness, his righteousness, his justice that sets the standard. However, when people reject God as the creator, they no longer have reason to hold to any of those standards. I'm going to read to you today, I don't normally do that, but just a couple of pages from David Berlinski's book, because I think it displays so clearly where the last two centuries of secular thought have taken us, in a world that more and more refuses to acknowledge the existence of God or honor him as the creator. He says this, "Like so many other positions, moral relativism has been promoted from the back of the college classroom to its podium. The West, philosopher Richard Rorty writes, has cobbled together in the course of the last 200 years a specifically secularist moral tradition, one that regards the free consensus of the citizens of a democratic society rather than the divine will as the source of moral imperatives. The word free consensus, although sonorous, comes to nothing more than the declaration that just so long as there is rough agreement within society, what its leaders say goes. This was certainly true of Nazi Germany. Many details of the final solution were kept hidden, but the view that the Jews of Europe were a problem requiring solution was so widespread in German society as to have appeared a commonplace." And then there's German, which I'm not going to try to butcher. As a thick-fingered German butcher might have said, "The Jews are our misfortune." The decision physically to kill them all expressed very nicely the free consensus of Germany's citizens. Had it not, the final solution could never have taken place. It did not reflect the consensus of citizens in Denmark, Italy, or Bulgaria, and in those countries there was no final solution. There was no mass deportation, and there were no extermination camps. And in all three cases, Nazi officials were left muttering in frustration at the fact that, curiously enough, these were places where people did not sufficiently appreciate the gravity of the Jewish problem. Curiously enough. Richard Rorty was, to great credit, honest in facing the consequences of his own moral posture. He had no criticism to offer Nazi Germany beyond a personal sense of revulsion. And let me just say there, that ties in very, very well with what we learned a few weeks ago about postmodernism and truth, right? That the truth becomes what you feel because there's no objective truth to compare it to. So he had a sense of personal revulsion of how he felt, but no moral objection to what the Nazis had done. Back to Berlinski. If moral imperatives are not commanded by God's will, and if they are not in some sense absolute, then what ought to be is a matter simply of what men and women decide should be. There is no other source of judgment. What is this if not another way of saying that if God does not exist, everything is permitted? These conclusions suggest quite justifiably that in failing to discover the source of value in the world at large, we must in the end retreat to a form of moral relativism, the philosophy of the fraternity house or the faculty dining room, similar environments after all, whence the familiar declaration that just as there are no absolute truths, there are no moral absolutes. Of these positions, no one believes the first, and no one is prepared to live with the second. This is precisely the dilemma in which we find ourselves. Can you believe an unbeliever wrote that? Berlinski wraps it up very nicely. If we no longer acknowledge God as the creator, if we no longer look to him as the source of moral judgment, then we end up with a mob mentality where a simple majority determines what is right and wrong, where truth is fluid and changeable, and where human life no longer has value. Just consider how many issues today are decided with this kind of free consensus of the people. Abortion, euthanasia, stem cell research, gay marriage, gender identity. The list gets longer and longer every year. But it's arrogant of men to think that they can continue in such defiance without consequence. That they do not recognize God as the creator does not change the fact that he is. Let's finish today by looking at Acts 17. Go ahead and turn there. In Acts 17, Paul is preaching to the men of Athens in Greece, which was the cultural center. It says in verse 16, it was a city full of idols. One commentary said that just about every pagan god that you wanted to worship, could worship, had a temple in Athens. In verse 21, it says they would spend their time in nothing other than telling or hearing something new. They're willing to entertain anything that comes their way. And Paul begins preaching to them in verse 22. So Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I observe that you are very religious in all respects. For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I also found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you." Paul is about to introduce the true God of the universe to them, a people who know nothing about God, a people who can't decide what they believe or who they worship, who live in a city completely filled with idols. He's about to tell them the most important things they need to know about God in order to understand who he is. And here's what Paul says in verse 24, "The God who made the world and all things in it." The very first thing Paul says about God is that he is the creator. He made the world and all things in it. And there's a second thing that follows right on its heels, since he is Lord of heaven and earth. He is Lord. He has authority over all things in both heaven and earth. He has this authority because he created all things. And then he continues, "He does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things." That must have sounded pretty shocking to a people who lived in a city filled with temples, right? Paul is saying that God is greater than any pagan god they have ever worshipped. Gods who do live in temples, gods who do need to be served by human hands. God doesn't need anything from his creation. Rather, he gives all things to his creation. We are born because of him. We breathe and continue to live because of him. Everything that we have was given to us by him. He is our creator, and he gives us everything that we need. Now look at verse 26. "And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and exist." Some people think that God created the world and then left it to run its course. But this passage contradicts that belief. God has determined our appointed time and the boundary of our habitation. He chose the era of history in which we would be born. He chose the place that each of us would be born, and he decides where we will live during the course of our lives. In him we live and move and exist. There is no moment that happens outside of God's plan. Our study this week said, God has a claim upon all things, both by right of creation and by right of his benevolent sustaining of all that he has made. Every breath, every beat of every heart, and every good thing given are all from God. I want to encourage you this week to think about the claim that God has on your life. Do you recognize that because he is the creator, he deserves our praise, our thankfulness, and our submission to his will? In Southern California, we live in an extremely busy culture. We have a lot of material wealth, and our lives can be filled with things that are just not that important. We sometimes struggle to give even 15 minutes each day to the Lord, spending time reading his word and coming to him in prayer. We have so many other things to get done. I don't say that to lay some big guilt trip on you. I say that because I want you to realize that if that's you, then you're missing out. You're missing out on knowing God. He created you for a purpose, for his pleasure and his glory. So don't waste your life on things that don't matter. Live out Romans 12, 1 and 2, which says, therefore I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. Take some time this week to consider creation in some way. With all the rain we've had, everything's going to start turning green, right? Spend some time outside. Go out at night and just gaze at the moon and stars and consider the God who created all that deserves our worship. It's becoming increasingly more difficult to follow Christ in our culture, but that does not mean that God has lost control of the situation. He is still firmly in control of all that happens in history. Look at how Paul's sermon ends back in Acts 17. Look at verse 30. Therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all people everywhere should repent, because he has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead. God has fixed a day. Right now, he allows rebellious men to go their own way. But there is an appointed time when the whole world will be judged in righteousness. We can look forward to that day with confidence, knowing that there's no one like our great God, the maker of heaven and earth. Let's pray.